This episode of the CE Drive podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the life insurance licensing program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits, live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com. And welcome back to the CE Drive podcast. This is Jason Watt. Thanks for joining us again. Today's episode will be good for credits for most jurisdictions. It'll be good for financial planning credits for the FPSC. It'll be good for life insurance credits in all jurisdictions. And I don't believe it will be good for ANS credits in the province of Alberta, but maybe. So I think it'll be good for most of the credits you need for this, but I don't think good for ANS credits in Alberta. I was at the CFP Board Academic Research Colloquium in Washington, D.C., technically actually in Arlington, just across the river, a couple weeks ago at the end of February. You'll probably be listening to this. Earliest would be, I'm going to guess now, early April. And while I was there, I sat down with a couple of my other participants and friends of mine, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. And we recorded about 40 minutes of audio. So again, a little bit of a different format from our standard format, but I think you'll enjoy it. I go to this session every year. This is my third year going, and I will continue to always go. So I want to take a couple minutes to talk about what the session actually is, what happens here. There's a lot to this. So first off, this session comes about at the call of the CFP board. And the CFP board is the equivalent to the Financial Planning Standards Council, or probably by the time you're listening to this, what will be FP Canada. They take care of the CFP designation in the United States. And one of the things that I really like, actually, something that I feel like Kerry List at Financial Planning Standards Council has very much been responsible for, is building a good relationship between the CFP board and the Financial Planning Standards Council here in Canada. That good relationship has gone a long way to opening up our opportunities for educators in Canada to get more exposure to what happens south of the border. And notably, in the United States, they do things a little bit differently as far as the CFP is concerned. So what happens with the CFP in the United States is most new CFPs actually graduate from university programs, or what they would call college programs, with a four-year degree in financial planning. And you'll find those are sometimes offered in business schools, or they're sometimes offered in human ecology departments, which when I went to school was called home economics, or occasionally they're in their own standalone departments, sometimes as part of a finance degree. And what happens then is those folks graduate with those undergrad degrees. A lot of them go on to do graduate and PhD level education. Now you have tons and tons of PhD level CFPs in the United States. We're starting to see some of them come up to Canada. We have a few folks in Canada who, while they don't specifically hold PhDs in financial planning, they really are PhDs whose focus is in financial planning, and some of them are working in financial planning departments in Canada. In the interview here, you'll hear Tanya talk about that a little bit. Tanya mentions that she anticipates the day when she can do a PhD here in Canada in financial planning, and I think that'd be interesting as well. I sometimes toy with the idea of going to one of the American schools to do my PhD. They generally have programs that allow you to do it on a remote learning basis. We'll see. We've got so much spare time. Just going back to the intent of the conference then. So the CFP board puts on this conference really to give researchers in the area of financial planning an opportunity to present their research in an academic forum. They have a journal that goes along with this, and the CFP board then has folks from all over the world to do presentations there. Lots of Canadians end up there, although they generally aren't financial planning researchers. We had a lot of economists there this year, actually. The conference normally has around 300 people, sort of a mix of academics and practitioners. You really get this mix, too, in the United States, where you have long-standing practitioners who go back to do their PhDs. You'll hear Ryan talk about this a little bit. Ryan talks about a presentation that I think we all enjoyed quite a bit with a fellow by the name of Ed Horowitz. Ed is at Creighton University. Ed talked about a really neat approach to getting people who weren't using their employer-sponsored retirement plan to participate in that. Ryan talks about that more in the ensuing interview. The thing I wanted to specifically mention with Ed is that he comes from an insurance background. He's very much an insurance guy, and he would look very familiar to a lot of the folks that show up in my classes day in and day out. 30 years in the insurance business. You can tell that Ed has sat across the kitchen table from people and done all that kind of stuff. He really brought a solid mix of his background as a good insurance agent into this. And he's a financial planner as well, CFP, but also now a PhD in financial planning. And it sits so nicely, that whole mix together. I really thought that was a cool presentation. So it's not just all academics for academics' sake. You see a lot of practitioners who are very much involved in this. There are a few things that get mentioned in the discussion here. There's some names that get mentioned. After the interview, I'll mention who those names are. I think it'll maybe be more relevant after the interview as to who the names that get mentioned are. But I wanted to go over a couple of concepts before we get into this. So Tanya talks a little bit about the concept of income security and precarious income. A lot of the research that we see at this event has to do with people of modest means or even lower net worth folks. And I would suggest a fairly strong body of research in the United States around trying to help people who are lower on that economic spectrum try to resolve their situations. There's a mixed bag of stuff here. Part of the reason that that's a big focus of research, honestly, is because it's a place that it's really easy to get lots of information. You'll find it's generally much easier to get reams of information on large groups of people who are at or near poverty than it is to get lots of information on large groups of people who are at a high net worth level. And you find a lot more commonalities at those more basic income levels. So it's something you see a lot of. It's really good work, and you still can learn a lot about decision making and financial outcomes here. I think you just have to be careful a little bit sometimes with why people are doing research and with the type of research that's being done. Anyways, when you're dealing with people who are in that more basic or that lower level of economic security, there are some terms that get thrown around here a little bit. We sometimes talk about food insecurity. Food insecurity is the kind of thing you would find at the United Nations level. When you talk about somebody who's impoverished, that's generally kind of the biggest indicator of impoverishment. We talk about income security or precarious income or transitory income, and those are all concepts that refer to how much certainty does somebody have around their income. And underemployment is a concept you'll hear as well. And then also the unbanked. You'll hear about people who are in that category of unbanked, meaning that they don't get services from traditional banking. It's a far bigger problem in the United States than it is in Canada. In Canada, you wouldn't find that many people, even low net worth folks, who are in that unbanked category. The color for today's episode is blue. The color is blue. Okay, I'm at Washington, D.C. Just wrapped up day two at the CFP Board Colloquium, and I'm sitting here with Ryan Laverty and Tanya Staples, and we're going to just go over some of what we saw in today and yesterday's sessions. There's only a half day left. Ryan is an instructor at Seneca College, in Toronto, actually, proper, right?
Yep, that's right.
Perfect. And Ryan used to be on staff at the Financial Planning Standards Council, and Tanya is an instructor at Conestoga College in Kitchener-Waterloo,
also a practitioner, and also, and we're going to hear about this a little bit, in the wellness business on top of that, right? Anything else I should add there? Both are CFP professionals?
Yep.
Basically, we spent the last day and a half in sessions seeing various academic presentations. Tanya and Ryan both had some favorite sessions, and I thought it'd be good to hear from them about what those favorites are. And we're going to have to flip through the book a little bit here. We have to cheat. There was a lot of sessions. Hard to remember all the titles.
There certainly was.
Yeah. So, Tanya, what do you have?
So, what we were just chatting about was there was a session on the timing of early life, family income, and adult obesity, and then present bias and financial behavior. And I think what I found most valuable, even if the results were a little bit skewed incorrectly, I liked the idea that that topic was being challenged. So what income looks like in households when children are very young, and they use a term here as transitory income. I'm wondering if the term that we use, precarious income, might be more applicable in the Canadian environment, or even something else that might be valuable to research would just be underemployment. So I think there could be an impact of those who are underemployed with young children in a household. And then so the research was there a correlation, and the age cohorts were banded in years of five, kind of between 19 and 45. And so the question I had posed to her was, why was the data set limited to age 45, given that we know primarily non-communicative degenerative diseases that are usually triggered by obesity, which is what she was looking at, why was it limited to that? And so she simply indicated that the data set didn't provide for ages over than that, but yet we actually know that the existence or the prevalence of those diseases don't usually happen until after 40. We don't even test in the medical field till after 40 for those diseases. And so I think they take a long time to become a disease, right? So you could actually be overweight in your 20s, become obese in your 30s, and then develop one of these diseases, but that could still be triggered by what you were fed as a child because of your parents' underemployment or precarious income. So I liked it as a concept. I think it would just be really valuable to change the years for the data set.
And I'll talk about data sets in a separate set of notes afterwards.
Sure.
I've learned a lot about data sets coming to this conference for 3 years now. Is there anything in that particular session you feel like you can take back to your students?
Absolutely. I think the value is in making sure our soon-to-be planners that we're teaching really understand the value of cash flow management and acknowledging the increased prevalence of individuals who are underemployed or who are paid precariously, right? And how you manage that from a cash flow perspective. I think that's very, very valuable, because in any of the teachings that we've done in the last few years, you've been given a cash flow, and it's always a monthly income, and it's consistent, and it's not going to disappear. So even though if we do emergency planning, we don't look at the fact, well, what happens if it's common to only be paid every 6 months? I think there's real value from a teaching perspective on that.
And I think that's something you would talk about, like in business cash flow, but you don't see it so much in personal cash flow discussions.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think that lends itself to kind of what you see in the competency profile. Ryan actually had a heavy hand in that competency profile. I think you did too, Tanya, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, if you develop a proper cash flow statement, I think it should reflect the frequency of income, stability of income, more than just the traditional list out income type of cash flow statement.
Well, and I think the only problem is in a teaching environment, every anomaly does not get taught, but yet I think this is becoming less of an anomaly, so I think there's now a need to potentially incorporate that into more mainstream teaching, where we do have students doing cases where income is precarious, right? So how do you manage that? And then how do you convince a client? I mean, it's almost like a sailor, right? So a sailor goes out and brings in a big haul of fish, and they spend it all at the bar before they get to the bank. Right? And I mean, that's in a long time ago, right?
Yep.
But again, getting them to put that aside, right? When sun shines, you make hay.
Never mind that. If you're a commissioned financial advisor, you better be used to it, right?
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. Yeah.
I think it's important to bring back to our students that idea about how important cash flow management is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, working in industry, especially in a firm where wealth management is the focus, you tend to take the client's cash flow as given. You ask them how much they can afford to invest with you, and you don't tend to look at their cash flow too often. And we can see from these studies how important the cash flow is to not only their current way of life, but their future, and now their offspring's future, what happens to their children and the type of behaviors that they grow up with and that they end up enacting as they become older.
Mm-hmm. I think that acceptance of cash flow as such a fluid concept, I think that's much wider today. The gig economy contributes to that. And
absolutely.
I think you have like three different businesses that you're involved
mm-hmm.
in. And, yeah, it's and I know teaching can be a little like that too today, right?
So. Well, the old adage of, you know, in business we talk about it, and like you say, we don't really say it much in the personal financial planning sense, but cash flow is king when it comes, or queen, depending on what you're chatting about. But it all starts and kind of ends with cash flow.
Yeah. So, Ryan, did you have a favorite session here?
Yeah, definitely. I saw one today by Edward Horowitz from Creighton University. His presentation was a financial psychology approach to increasing participation in employer-sponsored retirement plans. And the work that he'd done was actually done with Brad Klontz, who is well known for money scripts, which are unconscious beliefs that we tend to have about money that come from our childhood and our learnings from watching others use money, particularly those who are very close to us, like our family and friends. And so Ed and Brad actually put together a study that was built around applied research, where it was researching in practice with a company, the Mutual of Omaha, who had pension funds, or the equivalent of group RSPs that we would have in Canada, and wanted to see if they could get people who were not very interested in these types of portfolios or these types of plans, and see if they could reconnect them to the plan and get them to participate more. I found it really eye-opening that they actually stepped away from what we tend to do in financial planning is talking about money. They stepped away from the money piece, and they had people start to build out pictures of what their retirement was. And it wasn't just, you know, picture what retirement might be and picture it in your head, but they actually had them build vision boards. And they had, you know, grown adults, you might think it's silly, but grown adults using stickers and painting a picture with stickers of what their retirement might look like, and then presenting and sharing that with other people, which in its infancy of an idea is something that's scary for a lot of people, of getting up and sharing about themselves, especially with coworkers who, you know, in the particular fields that they were testing in the blue-collar industry, it might not be something that those people do too often. So quite interesting to see the results that they were able to get people to reconnect with their vision of retirement and continuously come back to what that vision is and then connect it to how much money do they actually need to meet that goal. And from there, be able to increase the participation rates and increase the contribution rates that people were making to save towards the retirement.
So I knew that they had increased participation, but the saving rates, the amounts went up also?
It did, yeah, quite significantly. You know, they had, and you know, I don't know the exact numbers, but it was close to, I think, 180 people. And of those 180 people, the contribution rates went up $200,000 between 180 people. So quite substantial, you know, for one small study. Bringing that back to my students, I think, is quite important. You know, we tend to focus on a lot of the technical knowledge, and let's talk about money, and let's collect the information we need to collect in order to analyze your situation and give you recommendations. But sometimes it's going even back further and saying, let's start with, you know, what are your beliefs about money? What are you concerned about? What does retirement look like? And let's get you something to get you excited about being part of the financial planning process. It's not just about me as a financial planner giving you what the answer should be. You as a client need to be involved in that. And in order to do that, visualization works quite well, particularly if you have something that you can continue to look at wherever you are at home or in a car or wherever, or something that you can continuously come back to, pull out of a drawer and say, that's what I was working towards, I need to revisit that again.
And not only, I think not only that though, if you take it one step further, the kinesthetics of it, right? So the actually physically peeling off stickers and assembling an image or a picture in front of you of your own retirement. You pull in so many more senses when you do that type of application. The process is also longer, so the retention of knowledge goes deeper, right? I've done something, not with stickers, but I think it would be a fantastic exercise to have our students do, mm-hmm. right? It's one of the things I do in my retirement planning class is I make the students, we have a session or some sessions on retirement income planning, but then we have a session on retirement lifestyle planning, and I make them plan their own retirement. And they're like, what? I'm 20. I'm like, but this is difficult at any age. So you plan your own retirement, and then you'll be in a much better position to understand why it's so difficult for people, your clients, to plan. I mean, if you can't plan your own retirement, how can you expect someone who's your client, who's 2 years older than you, to plan their retirement? Right? It's all about making it applicable and making it reasonable.
Well, and think about that. If you can't, the majority of our students are in their 20s, perhaps 30s, mm-hmm. if you can't plan your retirement when the pressure's kind of off, how do you think it feels for a client who's in their 50s and staring down the barrel of retirement's 10 or 15 years away and I haven't saved anything?
Absolutely.
The pressure that they're under to try and define what that retirement looks like and plan for it.
Exactly. Or even scenarios where you do one of these vision boards ahead of time and you take it home to your spouse, and at least it begins the conversation, because what happens if the visions are different, right? You don't want to find out the visions are different at 55 or 58 when you could find out maybe the vision is a little bit different at 40 or 35, right? There's so much value in that. I mean, the visions don't have to be the same, but at some point they have to connect.
I think that's quite important. When I was in industry, I found that so many clients, couples, were in that boat that they mm-hmm. had two completely different visions of what their retirement would look like, and that that was the starting point for our conversation, was trying to get them onto the same page mm-hmm. Before we even chatted about the money part or
Absolutely.
How much we need to save. They needed to both be happy with what that vision was going to be, and then work on how they would get there.
Well, I think there's so much value in that, because the other thing to realize is that when we do retirement planning, you revisit goal setting. And then often when you revisit goal setting, it would be interesting to look at, okay, so what would be the things that could possibly change those goals? And that's another lifestyle piece. So,
yep.
You may have a very similar vision with your partner until your children have children,
mm-hmm.
right? And then all of a sudden the vision changes, or it deviates for one partner, right? And I could definitely see that even impacting myself, right?
Yep.
And so again, you do this early enough with these vision boards, you just create another vision that says, okay, well, here's what my retirement looks like if we have grandchildren, right? So does that cost me more?
It does change your retirement vision.
Absolutely, it does. I'm fairly confident it would.
Yeah. It has for us.
Well, and I have three children, so I imagine I'm having some grandchildren at some point.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I think
later than sooner.
Yeah, probably.
The pressure, right?
I think it's the visual part of those vision boards was something that really stood out to me, because I know that 60% of what we see through our eyes is directly linked to our brain. A lot of those nerve cells are directly mm-hmm. linked into from our retina into our brain.
It's
and we understand things a lot better when it's visual.
Mm-hmm.
So many people, when you ask them to define what their retirement looks like or envision it, they can't put it into words. But they could put it into a picture format.
Absolutely.
Because they have this mental image. And if they can get it down on paper, that really helps open up the conversation, versus someone who says, I look like I see retirement and I'm going to go golfing and that's all I'm going to do. The idea of making these vision boards allows people to diversify what that retirement looks like. You've got an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, and you've got a sticker, and one small part might be golfing, but there's other spots on that page that you need to fill. And I think that's something to bring back to students, to say, from the lifestyle planning perspective, when you have these conversations with clients, it's important to say, what are you going to fill your days with?
Mm-hmm.
Because as much as people say, well, I just look forward to not working, Those people in that type of retirement tend to die early because they're bored and they don't have anything to look forward to.
Absolutely.
They tend to have physical and mental ailments. And part of our role as financial planners is to help with those transitions. So it's not just about setting up and saying you've reached this time in your life and you've attained this goal and you've got the cash flow, but what are you actually going to do?
Yeah. There was a poster session about that. I don't know if you saw it or not, but that's, the other thing that I noticed in that session that struck me was you talked about the tactile sense or kinesthetic sense, but they also engage smell and taste in the session, which I thought was brilliant.
I wondered when they chatted about that, how they were actually going to engage all five senses. And it was quite quite interesting to hear the soothing music they had.
Absolutely.
And they had a spritzer that they were spraying pleasant scents and things like that.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
That's the type of environment that people think really well in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Absolutely.
You mentioned posters, Jason. I did see one that I really liked it. A couple of PhD students had worked on it, and they had found that financial advice that was received from a financial planner really set people apart compared to those who didn't get financial advice from a financial planner. And so something that I've kind of always known, but it was nice to see that the statistics backed it up. What was most surprising to me was that the financial advice that people are getting from the government was actually making people worse off than if people had no financial advice. Now, I know it's an American study, and chatting with some of the individuals here, they say that financial literacy is lacking in the United States. And it's understandable considering that financial literacy is crossing all 50 states. It's hard to get a complete picture and get that information out to everyone at once. But it was just eye-opening to see that not all financial advice is created equal, and not from the people who you think would be giving good financial advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think it's probably in the delivery, right? So if you think about just the forms and the questions that are asked, even for something as basic as, in Canada, CPP or OAS. Mm-hmm. I mean, a story that I tell my students all the time is I had a former Bay Street lawyer who had been asked by his dad to come take over the business. So he did. So he went into a private business, and he called me and he said, "Would you give me an hour of your time and explain to me how to complete this CPP application?" And again, it's just that you're not sure with the check boxes, and if I answer yes to this, go to K, whatever. And it is complicated, and I think there's definitely some opportunity for policy to help figure out how to better inform individual Canadians about the government options that are available to them.
I think that story is important too just put forth that it's important not to prejudge someone.
Absolutely.
You would think a Bay Street lawyer would be able to fill in what we would consider a simple form, although it's not simple, but it's one of the more simple ones. And it's just interesting to see, maybe he doesn't have the time, he's never looked at it before, or it's not his area of expertise, but we would probably say, here's the form, or fill in this form, and you'll get your CPP. When sometimes we need to take a step back and say, what is it that I can help you with? And sometimes you'll be surprised by the answer. It might be something as simple as, help me fill out a form.
Absolutely. And I'm sure it was more of, just wanting to get it done and have it done correctly and not have it be rejected. But where they do become complicated is if you've worked outside of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you're entitled to another form of government benefit, right? And these things can get very complicated. One of the posters that I really found valuable was a research study done on financial well-being and financial vulnerability. And obviously it was interesting to me because I'm looking at financial viability currently. But what was really neat is that they had included a significant amount of objective measures, and so I found that very valuable because I'm trying to make it as objective as I possibly can. they had included some demographics that I hadn't thought about including, so I will definitely address those demographics also. And then they actually had included some psychometric stuff that had been vetted, which I didn't know there had been anything that would historically be subjective, but that had actually been asked in such a way that it could be quantified. So I really found that poster to be valuable, and I'm going to follow up with the author for sure to see how I could potentially pick her brain or run some things by her. So
I found it curious you talked about complexity with the CPP forms. And by the way, we'll get you back on when the research is done. I'm curious to hear about this, assuming you want to do this again.
Yes. Let's make sure I want to do this again. The research sometimes is killing me.
The opening session yesterday was Terence O'Dean, and
yes,
he talked about
right.
The investor's worst enemy.
Yep.
And I thought it was going to be himself, a la Benjamin Graham.
Yep.
And it turned out the investor's worst enemy was complexity. I really enjoyed that session, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, Ryan kind of snuck a second favorite in there. Did you have a second favorite, Tanya?
You know what? Did I have a second favorite? It's like you said, Jason, we have seen so much.
They had information on genetics and its impact on your financial net worth, your risk tolerance. That was some of the sessions.
It's my second time here seeing a genetics session. I feel like it's only a matter of time before you go to your financial planner with your 23andMe in hand or whatever.
Or they get the little pin out and take your blood there and then.
The other one was the EEG one.
Yes.
So that was very interesting. So what it was determining whether or not, so it was a very small sample size, that's the problem, only 19 participants. So a control group and a treatment group, and they had asked them questions about risk tolerance and wanted to determine whether or not the answers that they spoke correlated with responses in their brain while they were wearing an EEG. And I thought that was really fascinating because we have seen crossovers between medicine and finance before, but just the value of thinking about when I'm having a financial conversation with my client, is what they're telling me what they actually feel. And so it was one of my interest was triggered for that in a previous research study that I've read in medicine that says men are more likely to be honest with a female doctor than they are with a male doctor because of macho ego and or feeling that a woman would care more about their well-being, right? And so very interesting about how people respond based on whether or not they feel confident in answering, right? And so to know that the correlation was that people who are more risk-oriented had a much greater response in their brain from an excitement or motivation perspective than they may have communicated verbally. So I found that to be a fantastic, I really valued that. I thought that was very interesting.
We had another session where we heard that men overstate their risk tolerance.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
That makes perfect sense,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's funny, so even in my own household, being married to a physician, often you'd think, and a very, very detail-oriented physician, people would always assume that his risk tolerance would be lower than mine because I'm in the industry and I'm more risk-averse than he is, right? And it's funny, we make these assumptions and these conclusions based on what we've seen, and sometimes they're not accurate.
I found in that particular study you were just chatting about, what really stood out to me was the presenter's idea and truthfulness that the brain doesn't lie. We hide things with our body language. We don't always tell the truth with our words.
Exactly.
But the brain and the scans of the brain that he had were lighting up when certain words were used. And it makes me wonder, where we may have to go in order to get a true understanding of what an individual's risk tolerance is. And when you connect it to some of the studies and meetings happened at last year's colloquium here around risk tolerance, and even the questions we ask, that the risk tolerance questionnaires are not a true measurement of an individual's risk tolerance. that there's a lot more to it than what we're asking now. I wonder where technology is now going to perhaps cross into this this realm. Maybe it is something, you know, and we joke about you might have to come and get your genetics test done and get your finger pricked when you come see your financial planner. It might be that you come and wear one of these brain scanners as they ask questions, and your brain won't lie to the planner. So,
well, and even as interesting as the presentation last year on your biological age versus your chronological age, mm-hmm. right, and being able to measure that because of technology, or you know, if we go back to the risk tolerance, one of the things that I think, because especially a lot of the research that Sean Brayman's been involved in around the psychometric analysis piece. I think it's just that is very fascinating because I think there's an opportunity for technology to play a role in that. I'm not sure what, but even when I teach that to students, I spend a lot of time trying to get them to understand the difference between an individual's capacity for risk and an individual's willingness to take on risk. And
for
so
sure.
One of the things that I always caution students is that if you have someone who seems to be excessively aggressive, it's really critically important that you analyze their capacity for risk so that you don't miss the cues, because chances are not maybe conscious dishonesty, but just a lack of knowledge dishonesty is going on, right? So they're saying these things because they don't know. They're omitting information because they simply don't know. And so just making sure that students that are in our programs understand how important the capacity is, because someone's willingness could be, you know, off the charts, right? And it not be accurate based
on
the research.
Can you actually afford to take a loss?
That's exactly it. Right? And they often, in people who are very aggressive, they often only see the upside.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's the problem.
Yes, exactly. So one of the reasons that I think we like coming to this conference, too, is the chance to sit down and chat with, like, I see you guys a couple times a year, and that's
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and it is a pleasure to see both of you always. I don't know if you feel
well.
The same.
Yeah, definitely.
That's kind of forced. I had to pull that out of you. But, but who have you met here that's been, and we're sort of in the company of people we never get to see. So who have you met here? What conversations have you had at the conference that have had value that you can take back to practice or students?
I think for me, it's all of the Canadian educators that are attending the conference. It's great to be able to bounce ideas off of them, especially as the financial planning field is changing. What are they focusing on in their teaching? What are they bringing to their students to help prepare the next generation of financial planners? And that helps me go back and kind of calculate and develop what I would do in the programs that we have at Seneca. I also like meeting people, particularly PhD candidates who are presenting at the conference. They give us a different vantage point, I think, of the financial planning field. A lot of what we know intuitively, or we feel we know intuitively about client behavior, is now being proven. And so it's making me much more aware that when I'm teaching something, what I'm saying isn't necessarily, you know, the gospel truth. It's my belief. But can I go out and find a study that mm-hmm. is going to back that up and bring that proof to my students to show them that there is really a whole academic field behind this profession?
Mm-hmm. That's definitely something that I very much value. I think in similar conversations around, you know, meeting some of the academics that are in Canada that I haven't yet had a chance to really have a conversation with. So chatted with Francois, chatted with Philippe and about his research and his paper, which I found really interesting. And then just even the conversations about the changes that are going on in the profession in Canada, and finding out how people are handling those changes, ideas that they have that I can then incorporate into my program as it develops at Conestoga. And then there's a few that I know from previous years where it's just nice that are from the US that you just get an opportunity to catch up and find out what they're working on or what their latest paper is. And I always feel very proud when I see how much research is going on. I look forward to the day when there's a PhD program in Canada. For those of us who would like to consider that at some point, maybe, I would like to, I mean, great programs in the U.S., but, you know, if I didn't have to go to Kentucky or, you know, Texas Tech or something like that, I probably would prefer to stay at home. especially to make it applicable, right? I mean, it's nice to learn about another program in another country, but would like to really know that when I'm applying tax laws, it makes sense, right?
I also feel very proud to, when I come to an international colloquium like this, the financial planning profession in Canada is 20 or 25 years old, and the U.S. has had it for 50 years. And it's interesting to hear that they are struggling with some of the same issues we are having, around, you know, who can call themselves a financial planner and that title restriction. And it makes me proud to see how far and how quickly the Canadian landscape is moving with that type of issue. Much quicker, and it seems much more together as a country than the U.S. is. At the current time, we've heard lots of information that the U.S. is really struggling with making sure that people are registered and licensed appropriately, and those who are giving advice are qualified to do so. And we've always blamed, kind of ad hoc, that the provincial system in Canada with our security regulation and insurance regulation has been the issue because we couldn't get, you know, 10 provinces and 3 territories to all agree. But here in the U.S., where they have a national and a federal Securities and Exchange Commission, they're struggling with the same types of things when we think that that's the solution, having one overriding body.
We'll probably have policy before they do.
You know, and that's what makes me proud to think that,
in
a span of 5 decades, they haven't been able to solve this issue. And in the span of 2 decades, we've identified it's our issue as well. And we seem to be moving much more towards that solution that people are asking for, and that it will come probably soon.
Well, I'm sure the political landscapes have an impact, right? And I'm not talking about who's in power, not at all, but the different power at the U.S. state level versus how provinces interact with the feds in Canada. That has a huge role. I think the task force that Jane Rooney oversees, I think that definitely has had a positive impact in maybe not moving the policy needle, but pulling people together, right? I definitely think that pulling people together, making sure that the vision is the same, because I think a lot of us do share the same vision, regardless of where we are in the industry. I'm really looking forward to new policy around title restriction and lots of things that are going on in the country that will really help consumers. I think it's excellent.
I think it's an exciting time for the profession itself. It's a tidal wave of changes that are coming, but that tells me that it's been a long time coming and that we need these changes. And I also think that, you know, as we have an aging population, as we have more people who are trying to become financially independent, who want to buy houses, who want to send their kids to school, who want to retire, all of those things are creating this demand for financial planning. So it's a great industry.
And the complexity.
And the complexity of it,
yeah,
definitely.
Absolutely.
It's a great industry and profession to be in, and I think as these changes occur, they're going to change for the better. And I think that anyone who's looking to get into the profession should feel confident that that it's a profession worth pursuing, and that it's a profession that you can make a living out of and get the benefit of being able to help people and be able to pair those two things together.
Perfect. So just one last question. It's predominantly academics from Canada at this session. Even the Americans here are predominantly academics. There are a few practitioners. Would you have any comment for a practitioner who might consider attending this session? You think it's worthwhile, or is it too esoteric?
I do think there definitely are some esoteric tendencies. I think it depends at what level they're practicing. So if this is someone who is doing comprehensive financial planning, who's really looking for what it is that they're offering their clients to be backed by really good research and information, I think they would get value. Or someone who really likes just academia and incorporating that into their practice, I think there's value there. I do think that a lot of practitioners would struggle, given that it is a lot of information about data sets and regression analysis and things that aren't in normal speak. Right?
Definitely to brush up on your stats to get some value out of this.
Absolutely. Yeah. Even myself, there's some times where I'm like, oh my goodness, it's been so long since I've done stats myself. Yeah. And I think, too, sometimes when you get in the academia space, what academics do really well is the research and not necessarily the delivery of the information. Mm-hmm. And so that would always be a concern for myself, for practitioners who are, I think if the research is good and the delivery is excellent, more people would benefit. But I think it's difficult often to find a really good researcher who has also mastered, you know, the art of communication, right? Definitely two sides of your brain, right?
I totally agree with that, and I think it's an opportunity for practitioners to attend this event and speak with academics and ask questions that they want to know. How does their research affect them as a planner, affect their clients, and be able to say, you know, it's about communicating. While there is a lot of math and a lot of statistics and data sets, you know, the opportunity for lots of practitioners to come and be able to share their experience with academics might help bring that around, that academics have the ability to really work with those data sets and bring to light the findings from their studies, but be able to communicate them in an appropriate way. So I think, you know, perhaps it's a little bit of the cart before the horse type of thing, where the more practitioners that come, the academics may start to communicate towards them rather than the academic field.
Well, and that actually, I think you really touched on there on something there, Ryan. I think if we were to make a suggestion at all, it could possibly be about listening an opportunity where there's a panel of practitioners and researchers have the opportunity to find out what the challenges are, and they can then take those challenges back and do research on them.
Yeah.
So it might be a very interesting, almost like a flipped classroom scenario, right? Whereas rather than putting the academics up, let's put some practitioners up who have really challenging questions around whatever they may have,
yep,
risk tolerance, retirement planning, what have you, and have, you know, pre-prepared that the academics are actually there listening to say, okay, can I find a research study out of all that information that was just shared with me? I think there could be great value in that. We may have to share that information.
I think it comes from Tanya and my role in the college atmosphere. We look much more at our institutions at applied research. That is, the studies are done in conjunction with real people who are not in a lab environment, and it's using those individuals who are taking care of their business every day. And I think that allows people to really see the scope of studies and how they can affect their financial planning. But I also think it allows practitioners to get involved more in academia and learn some of the mathematics that are required. And they can become involved with presenting those results. You know, we started this conversation with the idea of what my favorite presentation was, and it was given by a practitioner who switched into academics or academia. And one of the things I really liked about it was that he kept it simple and put it in terms of what a practitioner needs to know.
He really presented like an insurance agent.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that really stood out to me, and it allowed me to understand the material better.
Yeah.
And that's what I can now take back to my students much more easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, perfect. Thanks very much for giving me some of your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you very much.
You'll be able to get your continuing education credits by going to bccquiz.online, that's BCC as in Business Career College, bccquiz.online, and there's a little quiz you'll do there, just a few questions, and if you're already a subscriber, then it will issue you a certificate. If you're not already a subscriber, then you will have to sign up, and you'll be able to sign up there, and you'll be able to get your continuing education credits that way. This episode of the CE Podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the Life Insurance Licensing Program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits, live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com. Okay, you can hear that Ryan and Tanya both felt like it was a valuable session and they learned a lot. I always feel that way. That's my third year going, and as long as I can, I will never miss it. One of the challenges for practitioners in Canada is the session falls right at the end of February and typically doesn't run well with RSP season. I would still suggest if you can get there, I think it's absolutely worth going. If nothing else, it really gives you an idea that you are operating in a profession where there is proper research being done. I think a lot of times people assume that whatever happens in sales meetings and we kind of figure it out by talking to each other, but you can actually see that there's a fair bit to this. So a couple of the names that came up here, Tanya mentioned a few names and I just want to clear up who these folks are. So she talked about Jane Rooney. A lot of people know who Jane Rooney is. So she heads up the Financial Literacy Task Force. She's also the, director of the Financial Consumer Affairs Canada. Since that Financial Literacy Task Force has come into being, I would suggest that they've actually done some pretty good work. We're starting to see more provinces adopt or seriously talk about adopting financial literacy programs in their schools. We have that now being adopted here in Alberta, starting at grade 4, assuming this curriculum survives the upcoming election. But it looks like starting at grade 4, there will be financial literacy taught in schools here in Alberta as a matter of curriculum. A couple other names she mentions. She talks about Francois, and the Francois she's referring to here is Francois Beauregard. Francois is from the IQPF. He's a volunteer there. I believe right now he's the vice chair, but he might be chair of the board. Their website says vice chair, but somehow I thought he was chair of the board at the IQPF. IQPF is the Institut Québécois de Planification Financière. That is sort of the counterpart to the Financial Planning Standards Council. In Quebec, they take care of the PLFIN, the Planification Financière designation in Quebec. They don't use CFP in Quebec, they use the PLFIN. Then she talks about Philippe, and Philippe is Philippe Destou from HEC Montreal, HEC Montreal. And HEC Montreal is a business school based in Montreal. They do lots of finance and management type of studies. It used to be properly called the École des Hautes Études Commerciales de Montréal, and they've had papers presented there the last few years. Tanya also refers to poster sessions, and what a poster session is, basically the talks or the presentations get divided up into three types of presentations. There are keynote speakers, that's the speaker in the whole room. Those are typically high-profile folks. One name that some folks might recognize that was a keynote this year was Kent Smetters. If you're a serious radio listener, you'll know who Kent Smetters is from the Wharton Channel. I mentioned Terence O'Dean. He's a fairly high-profile researcher. He was one of the keynotes. And then we have the breakout rooms. And that's where you have presentations on different papers. And then if you didn't get selected to present in one of the breakout rooms, then you get a poster session, which basically means you do up a little display and people come by and kind of check out your display. And actually, there's some really good stuff at some of the poster sessions. I had mentioned that I would talk a little bit about data sets. This is something that becomes a big deal, is what information is actually available? What information is out there that we can pull from in order to make determinations about how people make financial decisions, or what causes people to find themselves in difficulty, or what causes people to be better off financially, or whatever it happens to be. So when we look at data sets in Canada, we would know Statistics Canada, and StatsCan has fairly robust data sets that you can pull from, but there's lots of places that people get information from. We had some data sets that we saw at this conference from the IRS. There's a famous Dutch data set, so the government of Netherlands has been accumulating data from a whole bunch, about 2,000 survey participants for something like 40 years now. And basically what happens is they give these folks a computer and folks fill out information, hundreds of questions, and it creates this very robust data set. And that information is what we would call longitudinal, meaning it's not just at one point in time. You have a group of people that comes back year after year after year to present information. That information gets used in a lot of these research studies. Now, you heard Ryan and Tanya talk about the sessions that they really enjoyed, and I mirrored some of what they had commented on. I did want to give a shout out to one set of papers, or one actual poster that I saw while I was there. This poster that I enjoyed so much was presented by a bunch of researchers from either University of Georgia or Kansas State University. Some of you might know the name Christy Archuleta. Christy has been a guest on Michael Kitsis's podcast. She talked about the Financial Therapy Association on his podcast. Christy and then Megan Lertz is another one. I had lunch one day while I was there with Megan, and they did a paper about why risk tolerance questionnaires aren't necessarily that great a tool, because when we use the word risk, it doesn't mean the same thing to any two given people. So it was really an insightful paper, and it showed that maybe we have to do a little bit more work on helping somebody to understand what risk is before we start asking them how they would deal with risk in terms of risk tolerance questionnaire. I've talked elsewhere about the Financial Therapy Association. I don't want to get too far down this path, but one of the things that I really like here is this group of researchers, I find, does a good job of exploring some very fundamental questions that get to the heart of whether what we do as financial planners is really the right stuff, whether the process of financial planning is done properly, whether collection analysis and recommendation is the right way to do things, or whether there are different approaches that would be valid. And I like this. I think these are ideas that don't get explored enough. The other thing that I wanted to specifically comment on that I saw here, a professor by the name of John Grable. John is a well-respected academic. You can see he's one of the folks that kind of floats around this presentation. There's always somebody that wants to pull him away for a conversation. Really solid guy, and also one of the authors of Communication Essentials for Financial Planners, which is a book I've spoken about before on this podcast. But anyways, he presented a session where he talked about, again, actually a similar topic, some gaps in risk tolerance questionnaires. I was in that session and I asked him, so he's in University of Georgia, but I said, are you doing any work with any other regulators outside of the United States? And what he actually said, I was really surprised at this, and he doesn't know I'm Canadian. He said, actually, he wishes that American regulators would take this stuff as seriously as Canadian regulators do. And he specifically commented on the MFDA. He specifically said that he's had quite a bit of discussion with the Mutual Fund Dealers Association here in Canada about getting risk tolerance right. And it's something I do see from MFDA a little bit, where there's a recognition today that a questionnaire by itself does not fill the bill, that you have to have some evidence that you had an actual discussion with your client before you just rely strictly on a risk tolerance questionnaire. So anyways, I found it curious, and it was nice to hear that shout out to the MFDA. I know a lot of people will maybe not believe me there or whatever the case is, but that actually happened. I wanted to take a moment to thank Gilbert. I think I know who Gilbert is. He only gave his first name in his iTunes review, but Gilbert was good enough to pop over to iTunes and leave us a great review there. So thanks very much, Gilbert. If you could do like Gilbert did and pop over to iTunes and leave us a review, it's much appreciated. Reviews help us get more listeners. And I'm hoping that the folks that are listening would be good enough to also subscribe. If you pop over to bccquiz.online, again, that's bccquiz.online, that's where you can do your quiz to get your continuing education credits. If you're in British Columbia, you're getting close to your